Thanks for having me. My little traveling Ed man is right here with me. We've been all over the last 2 months in Saudi Arabia. Actually got his head chopped off in Saudi Arabia for some reason. I had to reattach it. It's true, actually. We've been in Malaysia and Singapore and now here. Mexico. So it's been quite interesting the last couple of months running around talking about this flat world swinging open, if you will. And fortunately, I was in Melbourne last week for the Moodle conference. So as I was swinging that trip and putting that trip together, somebody in Sydney asked me to speak down at Brighton Beach for teachers. So I was doing that yesterday and thought I'd spend a couple extra days here in Sydney and see my old friend Rick Bennett and see if I could pop over here, because there's a lot I hear happening at New South Wales. So I don't know if that's too loud on the microphone or whatever, but so I just was really curious to see the campus, actually. To be honest, I like seeing different campuses and getting a chance to speak on a campus. It's always a delight to be at somewhere I haven't been before. I've been in Wollongong, been in University of Newcastle, did Deakin last week and other places. So, and TAFEs in particular last time I was here. So I didn't get a chance to come here last time I was here. That was 8 years ago. And I was here in 2000 as well. Since that time, I've been focusing more on the book side of things, at least the last 4 or 5 years, and I put together two books, one that's got activities for teaching online, 100 activities, as he mentioned, real specific things you can do in your classrooms. That came out 2 years ago with a model called Read, Reflect, Display, and Do, or R2-D2. So it's, I have a Star Wars outfit that I wear. Rick remembers that maybe for that. And I'm currently working on something related to motivation and retention online with a model I presented yesterday down at Brighton Beach called Tech Variety, where every letter of Tech Variety stands for a motivational principle. So I'm very interested in the applied side, all you instructional designers, and what do you do? This talk here is different. This talk here is the big picture and what's going on. And now I've posted all 12 talks I'm doing in Australia, and this is the last one. They're at my website. You can just go to trainingshare.com. Trainingshare.com. You can get this talk in color PDF is posted. Go under archived talks. Look for archived talks at TrainingShare. And TrainingShare will also have resources. It'll have a whole slew of resources related to teaching with technology and so forth under resources. One of those I developed recently is a portal for video on the internet. I see a explosion of shared online video. Some of you over in that table are talking about putting together things with Camtasia or Captivate or whatever with video. So if you go to trainingshare.com, you get a list of 40 shared online video sites. I'm just going to give you a couple of web links just to start off with before I get going here. So TrainingShare has all these talks in Australia under archive talks. This talk's on my book, The World is Open, and the book has a website called worldisopen.com, which has all the web links that I'm going to go through here today, so you don't have to write all these down, as all the references for the book, has a prequel and a postscript. The prequel is called Sharing the Journey, sharing dot dot the journey, mapping out the last few decades of how in higher education and university and college settings, how we've moved from being a culture where 8 years ago in Sydney, 10 years ago in Sydney, people said, we don't share here, but Kurt, they're sharing in the U.S. And I go to New Zealand, they say, Kurt, you're sharing in the U.S., but we don't share in New Zealand, the same in the U.K. That was 8 years ago, 10 years ago, and I'd go home to the U.S. and they say, Kurt, we're sharing in New Zealand, they're sharing in Australia, they're sharing in the U.K., but we don't share here. Nobody was sharing. Nobody wanted to admit to sharing anything. Today we are sharing with many different sites around the world. In the U.K., they have something called Jurum. In the U.S., we have something called Merlot and Connections, and I'm going to walk you through some of these sites for sharing. Well, my site for sharing is The World is Open book, worldisopen.com, where I have an article explaining the history of sharing in higher education or tertiary education, and I have a postscript called An Open Letter to the Learners of This Planet with 10 Learner Rights and 10 Learner Responsibilities. I'm working on a free book, The World is Open book. I wrote too much, and I'm taking what we had to cut and smoothing it and adding to it and creating a free ebook that I'll hope to post sometime soon. I've been working on that for a long time, but I've been traveling too much. So those are a couple of websites, worldisopen.com, trainingshare.com, and finally publicationshare.com has all my publications that my publishers let me share. So you have to believe in the power of sharing, I guess, is the notion there. So I'm going to kind of give you, they've given me an hour and a half of time, approximately till 11:30. We'll open up for Q&A earlier than that. This will be actually slightly longer than the talk I gave at the Moodle conference and other places, because I only had 50-55 minutes there. So you'll get the more enriched, I think, more information, I hope. But really, many of you are dealing with strategic plans and where are you headed. So where are you going? And what is the shape of the world? You know, what is the shape of the world that we're in? Is the world flat? Is the world flat, as my friend Thomas Friedman says? And he sold 7 million books in an outright lie, telling people the world is flat, and people believed him. The world is flat. The world's not flat. But what he's saying is that economically, politically, and maybe socially, things have changed over the past couple of decades to enable people in Malaysia to compete with those in Australia, the UK, and US. That management processes have become flattened. When I was a corporate controller, I was in a cube farm. Today, employees have a voice through blogs, through wikis at Intel and IBM and other companies. They have a voice within the corporate setting. Things have become flattened that way. Things have become flattened in that collaborative technologies let people in other countries compete. And so we have new players from India and Eastern Bloc countries of Europe and China. We have an equalized playing field brought on by collaborative technologies, and management processes have become somewhat flattened. So the three P's, the triple convergence of Friedman's book, and there's Friedman there, those three P's have changed the world of business. Okay, not necessarily the world of education and training. And so when you look at his book, and how many of you have, anyone seen this book? Okay, a couple of you have seen it. Anyone buy it, actually have it and read it? Okay. When you read this book, as a couple of you have, you know the first third of the book, he's into educational change that is happening. He talks about podcasts and wikis and blogs, but it's the next two-thirds he does, and he stopped short of that. In the third edition of the book, he says in the first page, the number one thing people are asking him is about education and what to tell their kids. And at that time, I was corresponding with him a bit, and I said, you know, I'm going to work on a book that's going to be an edited book of people who have changed the world. And he connected me to his publisher, and I was going to do an edited book called The Heroes, Gurus, and Revolutionaries of the Shared Internet. So something like that. And a small publisher talked me into writing the book myself. And I lost the connection to his publisher as a result. I wrote a book called World is Open, and it became a, sort of a competing book, I think. I don't know. But you can learn, you can learn from Friedman's book by watching him at MIT. You can listen to podcasts. You can listen to, you can read blog posts. You can watch him on YouTube being interviewed by different folks. In the U.S., the world is, thinks the world is flat broke. Here, your economy is doing okay, apparently. But you can learn from his book in many ways. I learned from his book from a little thing called a playaway device, which is a little 2-ounce device in my ears as I went running. And then I listened to it in my car. So really, in terms of learning this book, there are many ways in which to gather the information from this particular book. In some ways, the world is maybe flat, as he's pointing out in this book. And if you get a chance to watch his little talk at MIT or others he's given in Singapore and other places, he's quite good. He has a new book called Hot, Flat, and Crowded, where the audience gets to write the last chapter of the book with him. So it's kind of when he revises the book, the next edition. He has his 10 principles, and these 10 principles supposedly indicate that the world's become flatter economically, maybe politically and socially. But a lot of these things, like digital learning, mobile learning, personal learning, virtual learning, wireless, relate to education and what's going on in the field of education. So when I was asked to give a keynote in 2005, in the fall of 2005 at the eLearn conference, I took his ideas and I spun off into education, and I called the title of the talk, Oops, I Didn't Mean to Share That. And I'll explain why I called it Oops in a few minutes. You'll understand why I said that. Anyhow, I corresponded with him. I was reading that, and you can see his three P's, his playing field, and so forth. My friend David Smick in Washington, D.C. says the world's not flat, the world's curved. And he tries to explain 401k plans in the U.S. and other retirement systems that were affected by the hedge funds that went belly up in many cases, all the problems of the mortgage industry during the past couple of years. And he tries to indicate that the world is sort of curved. Not sure. As a former accountant, I had to read or listen to this book a couple of times, and I still don't totally understand all the principles behind it. It's pretty deep in comparison to other books that are out there. My friend Richard Florida, misnamed Richard Florida, he's in Toronto, Canada, but you know, most of the people in Toronto spend their winters in Florida. He says the world is spiky, right? He says we have innovation spikes, creativity centers in places like Melbourne and Sydney and Seoul and Singapore and in Austin, Texas and Seattle and and London and other places. We have these spikes, these places where people want to congregate and live, where the creative capital fluctuates to of a community, and that it's not totally flat, it's not equalized. In part, he's talking about the digital divide, but in part, he's talking about, you know, places where innovation and new products are created, in effect. So he has a couple of different books. One's called What's Your City, in terms of where would you like to live, what fits you. It's kind of an interesting book. So is the world flat, is the world curved, or is the world spiky? I like this notion of spiky. It's kind of an interesting one. Others suggest that the world is open. And my friends have a book that came out about a year and a half ago called Opening Up Education, which is a free book. You can get this book off the internet from MIT Press. It's all in PDF format. MIT Press and Yale Press have done a good job during the past few years of making their books free and available to the world. Now, they were sitting in a pub in the Hilton in Houston 3 years ago, and I was sitting next to them working on my ideas for my book. We were there at a conference from the Hewlett Foundation on open education. They were doing an edited book. I was doing a single-authored book. And it was kind of funny that we just happened to be working on this thing sitting next to each other. And theirs came out first. It's a more deep and more academic book than mine is. Mine's more of a trade book. Mine hits the highlights of what's going on. Well, since I finished writing my book a couple of years ago, I started touring around the world, and people greet me. I'm in Malaysia 2 months ago, in Penang, and I was in Dubai or Abu Dhabi. And there's actually Dubai, Abu Dhabi, in Korea up here. I'm in Saudi Arabia. Everybody greets me like this. So if everybody could put their arms up in the air like this, I'll get your picture here later on when we're done. We'll get you all up in front. I was in Vegas a couple of weeks ago, and there all the vendors are greeting me like this. Went down the streets of Vegas, of course, and, people are greeting me. Okay, so, they wanted money for that, unfortunately. Okay, so, does someone have a book with them? I can raise this up a little bit here. Maybe we can put a book so we get the audio a little bit better. I don't know what's happened to the audio there. So I went traveling around in Las Vegas, and I found these globes. But the globe that intrigues me is this globe. This globe is internet-enabled. Thank you. This globe is internet-enabled. So you plug into the side of it, into the USB port, to get an update of census records and, you know, all sorts of economic data for different countries of the world or different states in the U.S. and so forth. When you have a web-enabled globe, my point is, you truly have an open learning world. When you have the chance for a globe to become web-enabled.
Looks like you've been missing a lot of work lately. I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
This is my daughter's favorite movie, but the point of this little clip is technology's changing all the time. All these technologies wrapped around us a decade or two ago, you know, floppy disks, right? We all got excited about floppy disks and VCRs and phones and whatnot, and today we're excited about other technologies, whether it's Blackberries or Wiis or mobile phones, iPhones, smartphones. You got the iPads. How many of you have an iPad? How many of you ordered an iPad or thinking about getting one? Yeah, a couple of you. Great. Yeah. So we've got new technologies today. And we get enamored on new technologies. But it's not just the technology that matters. And as I said yesterday, I presented on more of the pedagogical side. I call it nature and nurture. Technology provides nature. Pedagogy is the nurture. You know, we even have exercise machines in the U.S. now where you can work out and do your homework and your whatnot on a Macintosh computer. Today. So when, you know, we got technology wrapped all around us all the time. And I'm going to walk you through a lot of technologies here, in fact. But my concern is more on the pedagogical side and what we do with those technologies, which happens to be my other applied book. Now, if we go back in time, we can read from people like Vannevar Bush, who predicted the internet. He created a paper called How, As We May Think, written in the 1930s, before World War II. He had to put it in a desk drawer, and after World War II, he came back out with this article talking about the Memex computer, which talked about hyperlinking, talked about connecting your knowledge, your information, to pictures and video and other things through hyperlinking, in effect. He sort of predicted where the internet was going. He's no relation to George Bush, by the way, or big or little Bush, or either one. So you got people like Vannevar Bush, you got people like Steve Jobs, who've kind of pushed us ahead and thinking about where we're going. I'm going to be talking about him in my free ebook. In fact, I've written this up. I'm also talking about this gentleman, Charles Wiedemeyer. Charles Wiedemeyer taught the first course in distance learning. He was at the University of Wisconsin teaching this in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s. His book, Learning Out the Back Door, is the best book you can buy for $1 used on Amazon. Okay, it talks about this. Here's a kid here, the little Russian kid who can't get into the school. It's an elitist school. Another kid has access to resources. Back in those days, it made a difference. Today, with technology, whether we're talking about audio tapes in my car or CDs or whatever it might be, or my little headset, my PlayAway, or we're talking about the internet. Today, we've got resources wrapped around us. And you can walk in the front door, the back door, the side door. My score on the entrance exam for college wouldn't get me into Lower Potomac State University, which doesn't even exist, okay? My university that I went to, we didn't need entrance exams back in the day when I went to school, but now they do. My score wouldn't get me in, okay? But today I can be learning from Stanford and Oxford and Harvard professors on the internet for free, and I'm going to come back to that point that the world's become open for learning. This gentleman's name is Charles Wiedemeyer, and he's kind of influential on me because I was an accountant or a CPA board to tears in a cube farm, and his courses, his extension and outreach courses, I was taking, someone else was teaching them, right? It got me into graduate school. I needed to take some psychology courses to get into graduate school. I took these courses and I got in. Then I developed TV courses at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. So what is the internet? Is the internet an entertainment system, a writing aid, a communication system, a means to handle commercial transactions, a social networking device, or a learning tool? What is the internet? What do you think the internet is? All of it, right? It's all of that, you know. But I think if we focus on this part, on the learning part, and we maybe think about renaming and the internet and give it a new name, what would that name be? In chapter one of my book, I lay out that the name should be called the web of learning, or a web of learning, but the web of learning maybe. And if we did that, we'd have more focus on the potential opportunities for people of this planet, for learning, growing, and so forth. We have a networked society. We have podcasts, wikis, blogs, social networking, social bookmarking, digital photos, as Rick knows, so much wrapped around us via the internet today to learn, to help us become who we can be. We have this bucket holder thing called the Web 2.0. Some people debate, do we need this term, the Web 2.0, or not? I think it provides a lingo, something to talk about, that my kids know what I'm talking about. My mother knows what I'm talking about. The Web 2.0 is not an academic term. It's very simple. But it's a bucket holder for many technologies that wrap around us today. I think we're at a jumping off point. Here I was at the Golden Gate Park last year in San Francisco, but I think we're at a jumping off point to move to something beyond the Web 2.0. Some people are talking about University 2.0, Schools 2.0, Outcomes 2.0. Yesterday people were mentioning Library 2.0. I think actually people in the libraries are leading the way in many places. As I travel around the country, the librarians or cyberians know where we're headed more than most, but where are we going? Where's our plans? Well, in my book, I kind of pose that at the end. Where are we going? Where might we go? And I'll end with that. I start with this woman's story in the book. Now, she's a rugby player. I thought all you Australians would love this. I start with a story of a rugby player. Her name is Lily Henry Roberts. She's a 19-year-old rugby player at UCLA. As I wrote my World is Open book, I sent it to my friends, and they said, Kurt, the end of the book is fine. The beginning of the book, you have no stories. You need a story to start off with. And that day, I got an email from UCLA about their summer digs project. UCLA was having people go to Chile, Peru, Albania. In her case, she went to British Columbia. She went to Hope, British Columbia, 100 miles east of Vancouver, studying First Nation people from 12,000 years ago. She was blog posting on all this. She was corresponding with others about her adventure, if you will. So were all the other people around the world. These folks were in Albania. This woman was in Chile. This was their advisor. A couple points here. Any of you could sign up for this project. You don't have to be a student at UCLA. It means any of you could, you know, as long as you're over 18, you could sign up. You could be 80 years old, 90 years old. So the world's become open in terms of going off and doing this. Secondly, she influenced me. She wrote I asked her if I could include her blog post to start the book off. I was corresponding with her. I was in Indiana University. I was an armchair Indiana Jones, hence the garb here today. So, yeah, and I have my whip. Okay. So, you know, here I am in Indiana as an armchair Indiana Jones, and that's true of all of us. We can all be armchair archaeologists today, right? And we can be traveling the world with these folks, learning from them. As they're learning, you can learn from them. The internet opens the world for learning. The premise of my book is that anyone can learn anything from anyone else at any time. So it doesn't matter if you're in the Philippines, doesn't matter if you're, you know, in Antarctica. I'm going to come back to Antarctica. Anywhere around the world, as long as you have a satellite connection of some kind, you don't even actually need that, in fact. But a fascinating little project. The second story of the book comes from Melbourne, Australia. Okay, and I met this gentleman right here. His name is David Thomas. I met him last Friday for dinner. Now, we had never met before face-to-face, but he's the second story of my book. He's much shorter in person. When you look at him in this picture, he looks like he's taller than this Afghani, but you notice that he's up a little higher in the rocks. He's actually about this tall, and much younger than I expected, actually. But he was studying in Afghanistan. He'd been to Afghanistan 3 times. He was supposed to go a 4th time to do his dissertation, and his wife wouldn't let him go. I said, "Why won't your wife let you go?" He said, "My head could be chopped off, so I'm not going to Kandahar." So he couldn't go to Kandahar, and so instead of going to Kandahar, he used Google Earth to find 450 sites of interest that nobody knew about, right? He got on Discovery News. That's how I found out about him. He became the most famous archaeologist at La Trobe University in Melbourne, and maybe one of the most famous archaeologists in the world for his dissertation research without ever going physically to the spot. He prefers digging physically. He wanted to go. He says he's not scared. His wife was scared. Okay, he's been to Libya and Lebanon. He's been to Iran, Afghanistan, all over. He said the dodgiest place that he ever was to was where, Rick?
London,
the UK, because dogs were biting him, in fact. So yeah, you read the book. So, but he's got a blog post on everything. You know, he's blog posts, he's put pictures. He uses the internet to share his research. He's a digital scholar, if you will. We're moving into the notion of becoming digital scholars, right? This is a story that's going to be in the free book that I'm working on. We got 2 guys. We've got Michael Perm from the UK. We've got Zach Sutherland from Los Angeles, racing against each other last year to go around the world to be the world's youngest sailor solo going around the globe. Halfway through their trip, Zach was heading west, Michael was going east. They met in Cape Town. And they got to chat with one another. They're sitting on a boat chatting with one another, and they're blog posting on all this. And I'm corresponding. I could write them a message from Indiana. I'm an armchair Indiana Jones. I can do whatever I want. I can learn from them. Now, Zach was learning through a satellite phone. Zach was learning through Skype. Zach was homeschooled on his boat. When people can be homeschooled for their high school or secondary school on a boat traveling around the world, and he was actually being chased by pirates in Indonesia and had to take his rifle out to scare him away, actually halfway through his trip. A little scary stuff. Times have changed when all this is happening. Now, Michael was the world's youngest sailor to go across North America, to go across the Atlantic Ocean, I should say, go across the Atlantic. He was trying to become the world's youngest sailor around the globe. Zach won. So USA, hey, you know, Zach got there first. Unfortunately, when Michael came into port, he was younger by a month. So the Brits had the record, had past tense, right? You all know the story, right? They met in Cape Town and were heading out to sea when they found, on their boats, they found out that the world's oldest sailor was coming into port, the world's oldest solo sailor. His name is Minoru Sato. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right. Any Japanese people in the room, help me out. He was coming into port, so they waited. They found out he was coming by looking on the internet. So they waited, and they got apprenticed. Here's someone who's 75 years old, 6 decades older, apprenticing these 2 16-year-olds. And only made possible through the internet, only their mentoring, their cognitive apprenticeship is displayed on the internet through their blog posts, their video posts, and whatnot. Now, Zach's sister here thought she could do better. So she set off in California last year to be the world's youngest sailor. As you all know the story, right? Abby went off into waters. Unfortunately, someone from Australia has the record. Well, maybe fortunately for all of you, right? Jessica Watson came in a month or so ago, a month or two ago, as the world's youngest person to go around the globe solo. And as you also may know, Jessica came in, but Abby's blog talked about her being stranded. Abby had got hit by a 30-foot-odd waves, right? And those waves almost did her in. They thought she might have died, but she got found by Qantas Airlines. So apparently Qantas sent out some planes to go and find her, and she was picked up by a ship a few weeks ago and was taken through back up to an island. I forget which island they took her back up to. So the point of the book is that anyone can learn anything from any time. And if we look at Indiana Jones, kind of this notion of Indiana Jones, their treasure wasn't gold. Their treasure was knowledge. Knowledge was their treasure. I'm not sure how many of you have seen the most recent Indiana Jones movie. Older people like it. Younger people don't like it. But, yeah. Here's a little quote. I like Indiana. Okay. So, if the internet, which has 53 trillion pages, had just 0.00001 that's educational, that's all we need. People talk about the junk that's out there. We can have 52 trillion pages of junk. Give us a trillion pages of good stuff, or half a trillion pages. We got plenty of stuff to find out there. Now, my book, I'm going to walk you through the 10 openers. And these 10 openers spell the acronym We All Learn. Web searching in the world of ebooks, e-learning and blended learning. The availability of open source software and free stuff. Rick told me if I said free five times today, I'd get good evaluation. So free, 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 free. Leveraging resources and open courseware, the MIT stuff and others, you know, the OpenU in the UK on the internet. Learning object repositories and portals. These first five are just shovelware. My friend Ron Oliver at Edith Cowan talks about shovelware, putting stuff up on the internet. Catherine McLaughlin at Australian Catholic talks about shovelware with Ron, his former student. Then the next five get us into active learning. Learner participation in open information communities in YouTube and Wikipedia, electronic collaboration, synchronous and async, alternative reality learning, massive gaming, real-time mobile learning and portable learning, and networks of personalized learning. So we all learn. Now, every chapter of my book, I talk about my grandfather. My grandfather walked in one door of his high school or secondary school and walked out the back door and never went to high school. He instead built tractors. In my little city of West Dallas, Al's Chalmers Tractors. My father worked there briefly. My mother worked there. My uncle worked there and lost his job in 1986 when it closed down. These are the jobs that don't exist anymore. And my point within the book is that there are technologies and pedagogies that could maybe excite my grandfather and other people like him to complete their degrees. Now, he was born in 1907, exactly 100 years prior to my starting to write the book. So it's kind of a little play back and forth within the book about my grandfather in the book. Anyhow, I'll get the people on this side of the room to be the we people. People in the middle will be the all people. People on that side will be the learn people. So say it with me, everybody. We all learn. We'll try it again. We all learn. There we go. I knew you could do it. All right. So Friedman had his three P's. I have my three P's. In education, we have piping, infrastructure, wired or unwired. We have pages of content. As I mentioned, 53 trillion pages of stuff. And then we have a participatory learning culture. Times are changing, if you will, online. So these three P's are different from Friedman's three P's, but it's a triple convergence. And if any one of the 10 trends had happened today, any one of the 10 I pointed out earlier had happened, the world would be different than it was when I went to school. If one person learned online in 1950, that person would have been Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Today in the U.S., 4.5 million students in university settings learn online. Over 1 million secondary and middle school students learn online. Okay, so lots of change. A year ago, I was in Seoul, Korea, and I was walking through their library at Yonsei University, and I found these kids doing active, participatory kinds of learning around games and so forth. But every level of the library had a different kind of learning taking place. The first floor was social. The second floor was collaborative teams. The third floor was individual, learner-computer interaction kinds of things. The fourth floor was more counseling services. Every level, they had a different type. And I see this in Glasgow Caledonian in Scotland. I've seen it in other places where they try and create learning activities. And these are face-to-face. The internet offers us similar kinds of things for interaction that's collaborative, interaction that's individual, interaction that might be more playful and participatory and so forth. Okay. The first opener gets us into Web Searching in the World of eBooks. And some of you might say that's two openers. In fact, it is two openers, web searching and eBooks. But you need the internet to access these eBooks that are online. So I start with two in effect. But you actually, in some ways, don't need the internet. In China, there's a project called the 1KG Project, where people bring 1 kilogram of stuff with them to kids in Western China. They sign up on the internet. The kids in Western China don't have the internet, okay? But they're impacted by the internet. They have the Twin Books Project, where people sign up to buy a book and a second book sent to kids in Western China. They give out two for the price of one, in effect. There's a project called Room to Read, where someone who had worked for Microsoft for a long time had gone off to Nepal, saw the kids didn't have books, saw they were under lock and key, so he came back with books, he came back to build schools, he came back to build libraries in Thailand, Nepal, and now parts of Africa. His name is John Wood. Those kids didn't have computers, but they're still impacted by the internet because people donated time, money, and talent online. So this, and I'll talk about other people impacted by the internet in different ways here. I'll talk about people in Africa in a minute. Anyhow, it's a little aside. There's a lot of announcements about books, e-books. The soft covers are creating e-books on the iPhone. In October, someone walked up to me and said, I'm reading your book on my iPhone. I said, no, you're not. So, yes, I am. There it is. My publisher didn't even tell me it's on the iPhone. He got it on soft covers. In 1999, I was on a textbook in psychology, educational psychology, and my student said, Dr. Bonk, your book's an e-book. I said, no, it's not. Sure it is. No, it's not. The publishers didn't even tell me who co-authored the book or the instructors. Back in 99, 2000, 2001, publishers didn't know how to price these things. They didn't know how to market the e-books. It was up and down every year. Is the year of the e-book? It's not the year of the e-book. Year of the e-book? No, it's not. We're back to this notion. Is 2010 the year of the e-book? I was asked this at the Moodle conference. That was the number one question. I think 2012 might be the year of the e-book. I don't know. It's changed, but we're finally at a tipping point. More than 5% of university books today in the U.S. are e-books. That's a tipping 15. We get to 15, 20, and so forth. We will be there. We have a bookstore called Barnes & Noble. That's the president of Barnes & Noble with his Nook. The Nook, where you can walk down the aisles of Barnes & Noble, order an e-book on your, and then actually share it with your friends. Okay. Web searching the world of e-books, what happens then? We all learn. Yes, you guys are quiet here. Okay. My friend Terry Anderson. Does anyone know Terry Anderson? Recognized from Athabasca University in Canada? He has a book called Theory and Practice of Online Learning, which is a free book. Hundreds of thousands of downloads. A few years ago, I was in Edinburgh, Scotland, at the Alt-C conference. He told me, normally he sells 3,000 copies, 4,000. He decided to make his book free, and he's become, you know, it changed his reputation, in effect, around the world.
Because you can cut and paste, you know, this electronic.
You can cut and paste pieces of his book into other...
citations.
Uh-huh. All the citations, too, off of the book, even. Yeah. It's very convenient. So you're using it. Yeah, that's true. And they're hiring a lot right now. They've hired away some people. Athabasca is growing in Canada, by the way. And so his book made him popular. My friend Cory Doctorow from Toronto, another Canadian. Canadians are always doing more than anybody else, right? Cory dropped out of college 4 times. And he became a fellow at USC despite dropping out of college 4 times. He never finished. Because he has his popular blog, Boing Boing, a cultural blog, and because his books are free. He makes all his fiction novels, he writes science fiction, free. And he says it's like blowing dandelions. The seeds go out and germinate, people buy his books, and he sells more physical books because of having an e-book available for free. Now, in Korea, they're building digital textbooks for kids. They're starting with about 170 schools this year, with hyperlinking, study aids, simulations, animations, all built within the book. They want to have every school in Korea to be have free digital books, in effect, by the year 2012. So we have to look north from America to Canada. We have to look west to Korea. You have to look north. And we also look west to California. The governor of California, Arnold, would like to have free books in California because their budget's so bad. They have a $26 billion deficit in California. It's a lot of money to be in the hole. They spend almost $500,000 on books, textbooks. So they're going to create ebooks. That's their initiative. I don't think they're going to save money initially, but what they will do is lead the way. I think the Koreans, the Canadians, and the Californians, the C and the K people, will be leading the way in the digital book revolution. Now, also in California, we have the iPad. And we have Steve Jobs creating the iPad, which some people look at as a social tool. Those of you who have an iPad, raise your hands again. Are you using it? Did you ever show someone what's going on your iPad, or you only use it individually? You should do it more socially. They're finding it's different than the iPod or iPhone, that the iPad is more of a social device than a typical notebook or desktop computer. So we'll see if that's true. There actually is our universities in the U.S. giving away iPads to every student coming in. There are universities giving away iPhones to every student coming in and Mac laptop Airs as ways to get new incoming freshmen into their university settings. So they're using it as an incentive. There's a university called Seton Hill University, not Seton Hall, Seton Hill in Pennsylvania doing that. Number two, opener number two gets me into Oprah Winfrey. You might wonder why I get into Oprah Winfrey, one of our famous, you know, TV hosts in the afternoon shows. But Oprah Winfrey had a course on spiritualism. 2 million people signed up to take her course on spiritualism for free. And she had 600,000 simultaneous downloads of the video cast, of the webcast. They're doing a podcast on this talk, but they had a video cast. Now, in 1995, I combined PictureTel and CUCME together for to bring in authors of books who we were reading into my class for free. My president wrote me an email and he said, Kurt, don't do this. You're going to take down the internet. You've got 20 students in your class. It's going to, you know, you're combining two video conferencing systems together. It's not going to, you know, you're going to cause us damage our reputation. That's 1995. 20, 30 people in a class. They're worried we're going to take down the internet. Today, she has 600 to 700,000 simultaneous downloads, and you don't even know about it. You haven't even heard. We people yawn at this stuff, right? Today we yawn at all this stuff. 2 million people in the class, we yawn. It's front page, you know. And the other thing is my mom reads about in the paper before, you know, it's just common news today. This is just stuff that's going on. People know about the internet as a learning tool. Shaquille O'Neal, I don't know if you've heard of Shaquille O'Neal, our basketball star. He got his degree online or blended from the University of Phoenix, an MBA. When Shaquille O'Neal has this and Oprah Winfrey and all this stuff, people take notice. When Bill Gates makes online learning a top 10 initiative of the Gates Foundation, which means billions of dollars. Now, Gates is concerned about lectures being done over and over and over again and not having, you know, having so many on one topic. He wants to have high quality contents that artificial intelligence can grab, so it's indexed in a database and things like that. I'm not sure if I was in his shoes, if my focus would be online lectures and making it more effective, I'd be looking at other interactive and engaging things that could be done online. But at least you see there's some attention being made there. This gentleman here, his name is Salman Khan. Now, Salman Khan was tabbed last month by the Chronicle of Higher Education, our higher ed journal, as the professor or the instructor in the United States. Now, he doesn't have a PhD, but he has 5 degrees. He has 3 from MIT and 2 from Harvard or something like that. He's a pretty smart guy, engineering, computer science guy. He was tutoring his niece. He's sitting at home tutoring his niece one day. They're in Bangladeshi and has others in India, and he's tutoring them, right? And people found out. He's tutoring them in chemistry, money and banking, biology, trigonometry, math, statistics, you name it. He's putting videos up. And tens of thousands of people around the world started sharing these and went viral to millions of people now are watching these. And so he's starting putting up all these videos, over 1,000 in the Khan Academy. His name is Salman Khan. He has the Khan Academy. So very interesting gentleman there. In effect, that one person, my point of the book, one person can change the world. One person can have an interesting idea and change the world, right? And there are projects here in New South Wales where people are changing the world. Rick's project, for instance, is one. This gentleman in Bloomington, Indiana, is a person who's changing the world. He doesn't even check his email. I can't even get a hold of him. His wife, fortunately, is a sociology professor, but he was watching his son struggle with his college entrance exam vocabulary. So he created a website for his son to practice, like a little flashcard thing. And he decided to take that and get advertising at the bottom, and where you have, every time you get a question right, 10 grains of rice are donated to third world countries. Millions of tons of metric rice have been donated to Myanmar and other countries around the world through this website called A Free Grain of Rice. If you haven't seen this, it's a fascinating website. One person can change the world. It now has geography, it has math, basic math, language, French, German, Italian, and Spanish, has chemistry, has art, it has English, as I mentioned, geography. So it's, this, again, is a fascinating website. If you have kids who are struggling in their secondary studies, this would be a place to go. If you want to retool people before college, this might be a place to take and or create something like it. This little girl, her name is Adora Swivtak. Now, Adora is adorable. She's from Redmond, Washington, where her father works at Microsoft. Her father, though, is not a technology geek. It's her mother who is. And her mother has her going around the world doing talks. She is billed as the world's youngest teacher. She is now 12 years old. Here she is today, or close to today. She started when she was 6 years old, teaching online. She uses a webcam. She uses a Prometheus smart board. She types 110 words a minute. She has 3 books. Flying Fingers is her first book. We might do a book together. I'm not sure. We had dinner a few months ago. She's been on the TED Talks. If you haven't seen TED, which stands for Technology, Entertainment, Design, used to be secretive, but now it's open to the world. They like bring the best people, best speakers around the world for short videos on what, you know, technology, entertainment, design. She talked to these adults saying, you have to respect kids more. This is last month. She was at a TED Talk. But Adora is now 12. She started at 6. She's been teaching half her life. She's ready to retire, you see. Yeah. Now, think about it. And, you know, 2 decades ago, this was not possible, that a kid could not. She learns online from the Washington Virtual Academy. She teaches online. She teaches face-to-face. She teaches teachers how to teach writing. She goes into schools to teach teachers how to use technology to teach writing in particular. She has lots of advice. She teaches kids about geography, writing, all sorts of things. But she has a Facebook account. She has a YouTube, TeacherTube, over 1,000 videos maybe in TeacherTube. My friend Julie Young started the Florida Virtual School back in 1995, way down here, where they had 12 students. And the growth, they have 154,000 half-credit hour completions in 2008-09, over 71,000 students in the Florida Virtual School. This is a K-12 school, the largest one in the U.S. Now, the North Carolina people gave me a slide. I didn't include it in this talk. I don't think I have it in here. But they are growing even faster in North Carolina online, from nobody 3 years ago to over 60,000 just in 3 years' time in the K-12 schools in North Carolina. Florida, North Carolina, Michigan. In Michigan, you can't get a degree, a secondary degree, without one online class. Everyone has to take one online class to pass high school. Michigan's got a huge problem of the auto industry. They're also offering Mandarin Chinese within all the high schools of Michigan. A lot of interesting things happen. In Indiana, I can trip on our high school walking across our college campus, our university campus. It's called the Indiana University High School. It only has 4,000 students. It's not as big as Florida. But when it's bigger than Indiana University, in 5 years or 10 years, people will take notice. We have families going across the Caribbean. Their daughters are practicing their French lessons on different islands, and ship dock captains are practicing their examinations. Retired teachers in Grenada practice their examinations. They upload and download papers when they get into port. We have Native American flutists in our high school. This gentleman here, Everin Ozen, very famous Native American flutist kid. I listen to his stuff when I grade papers, in fact, and I found out he's a student in our high school. We have ballerinas, we have political activists and pianists. Fascinating things today. Now, that's in Indiana. If I go up to Minnesota, what do you see in the distance there in Minnesota? What do you see in the distance in Minnesota? You're from Navitas, right? You know what's going on. What do you see? Buildings. Max, what do you see?
High-rise
buildings. It's a little more definitive there. Rick, what do you see?
In the distance.
Yeah.
Sky.
We got sky, buildings, so forth. I kind of see that, but what I see is e-learning. You see, I was in Minnesota in early February, and I walked outside, and the concierge said, do you see that in the distance? That's the Capella Tower. It used to be called the Halo Building, and it's now called the Capella Tower. Capella is a fully online university. So when you look in the distance, it's not banks you see in the distance. They're all gone under in the U.S., You see, e-learning in the distance. You go to Denver, the Jones International University, something out of Dune, the book Dune. Fascinating when you see learning in the distance. Times have changed. Times have changed when you got the state of California dreaming about remaking online education. State of California is in a huge budgetary crisis. In the midst of this crisis, they're going to spend $250,000 per class to put them on the internet. They're going to take every introductory college class for the Cal State system. Calculus, physics, biology, macroeconomics, microeconomics, writing, nutrition, linear algebra, you name it. They're putting, and these are the class sizes, 48,000 kids a year take calculus, 38,000 take chemistry across the California system. It's a huge undertaking. They're going to get monies donated, they hope, to do this. They're not all going to get state monies or government monies. Times are changing when we got 1% growth face-to-face and 17% growth online in the U.S. And we go to Malaysia, you go from 800 students in the Open U of Malaysia to 90,000 students at the Open U of Malaysia in 10 years. They're growing by 10,000 students a year. The Open U in India, Indira Gandhi Open U, is over 2 million students. They have 100,000 students in every MBA cohort per year. Now, they don't graduate, but that's their cohort. Times are changing in Mexico. Mexico has gone from 2%, 1 in 50 Mexicans having online access 10 years ago. Now it's 1 in 4. I was down in Monterrey, Mexico. Actually, I got out of the hotels of Monterrey. 2 days later, there was a kidnapping in the hotels, not the one I was at. It's a little scary down there in Mexico right now with drug cartels and stuff like that. But they're pushing in the e-learning space. They're pushing ahead. And they've got the Open Monterrey Institute of Technology, 35,000 new students in the past decade through online learning. In Florida, they can't grow, they can't build buildings fast enough to keep up with the growth in Florida. My friend Chuck Zubin, Patsy Moskal, and Joel Hartman do research on online learning. They have a center called Research Initiative for Teaching Effectiveness, or RITE Center. They have over 1 million data points. So if you have faculty that don't believe online learning is effective, you can go to Central Florida, where they're using blended and fully online to grow. They're the biggest university in Florida. They're bigger than Florida. They're bigger than Florida State. If you want a better report, you can go to the U.S. Department of Education. They did a meta-analysis of online learning and found blended is best, fully online second best, and face-to-face is worst of the three. They have a free report done by Stanford Research Institute with the U.S. government. It's a pretty reputable report summarizing the state of online learning. So it's called an Evaluation of Evidence-Based Practices in Online Learning, a Meta-Analysis and Review of Online Learning Studies. This came out about a year ago. Okay? We also have what's called the Sloan Consortium, or Sloan C. They have an annual report on online learning. These are all free reports. Okay? The number one problem often of online learning is people resistant, reluctant, reticent, all the R words. When I was in the UK with Rick, we were at, what was that, London South Bank? And I went over to Leicester and gave a talk. We were up at Leicester, and one of the faculty is sitting there and says, "We're not resistant here in the UK. We're hesitant." Okay? Don't call us resistant. We just want to see evidence. So here we've got evidence, you know. We're just a little hesitant. Now, if you're interested actually in how to deal with resistant or hesitant faculty, I wrote an article or a couple things, and I'd be happy to send it to you. I wrote a chapter in my 2008 book that the publishers deleted, but it's the most popular chapter, actually. Number three gets us into open source software. We call Blackboard, Blackborg. If you have, I don't know what you're using here, Blackboard or Moodle or what are you, or a homegrown system. What are y'all using here? Blackborg, the Borg. I wrote a little blog post on Blackborg the Pirate if you're interested. It's kind of a funny little... Blackborg does a lot of getting people jump-started. It's a good tool to get people started. Okay, and they're now buying up everybody else. They just bought Illuminate and Wimba and other synchronous things last week. But in Indiana, we have Sakai. We have Chef Sakai, the Iron Chef on television. Because we kicked in $2 million... MIT get kicked in $2 million, Stanford and Michigan. Michigan had the CHEF tools, the Collaborative Higher Education Framework, the CHEF. They said, let's make the CHEF Sakai, the Iron Chef. And that's the name. Now, this came out in 2004 or 5, and it was overhyped and under, you know, it was over-marketed. They weren't ready. you know. But now it's good. It's a good little tool. So that's Chef Sakai. It looks just like every other tool. I'm using it in my class. But we also have... Let's try that again. Okay. We also have Moodle. I just got back from the Moodle conference. They gave me this as a little memento. Moodle. So there's Martin from Moodle. Now, Martin and I had a little debate last week, actually this week on Monday afternoon, about Moodle and where it's going. As you can see, Mel Gibson's using Moodle. Yoda's using Moodle. Cats and smiley faces. We've got 35 million people around the world using Moodle. That's a lot of people. We've got 930,000 registered users in 213 countries, 50,000 sites, 3.5 million classes, and this is as of a week or two ago, right? This is exploding, you know. And when I was when I met Martin in 2003, I met him at the start back in 2003, where it was just, and he wanted to partner with me. I had developed a web survey tool, and he wanted to partner with me, and I made a big mistake saying no. I recently sold that little software, but I should have partnered with him. But Martin's an interesting guy. He believes in a social constructivistic framework, an active learning framework within Moodle, and so he promotes that, if you will. He's off in Perth. He's in the Perth area. He had worked at Curtin with WebCT, but we were in Melbourne together this past week. The fourth opener gets us into leveraging our resources, MIT stuff on the internet, pirating, some people would say. Now, my friend here, Chris Anderson, actually, he's not my friend. He's kind of a jerk, but this is being taken. Oh, I didn't say that. He's a nice guy. He's a great guy. No, he's great. I really like Chris Anderson. He's got a great book. So Chris Anderson is editor of Wired Magazine. And I tried interviewing him for my book. And he said he doesn't deal in the education space all that much. But now educators are grabbing him to be keynotes, so I don't know where that's coming from. But he has a book called Free. He explains the free model or freemium models of products. He gives away the unabridged version of this book, audiobook. You pay for the abridged. Because people are busy, they'll pay for the abridged, they don't have time. Interesting little new book called Free. His previous book was called The Long Tail, explaining the music industry kind of dying out. Now my friend below him here, Wendy Ermold. Now Wendy is a science researcher from the University of Washington. She studies the water flow underneath the ice. She's getting upskilled on her chemistry knowledge and biology knowledge with her iPod in her earbuds are going on. She can replay it as many times as she wants. She can learn it however she wants, and there's no homework. She loves this notion of open courseware because she can get professional development skills that she needs, right? From Stanford or MIT or Seattle Pacific University or wherever she is. She's often in Greenland. She goes up by north of Alaska and all over the northern tundra. And so, we're pirating. We used to call this pirating. Now we call it sharing, right? So we're sharing stuff today. And there are people at Berkeley sharing stuff, right? They're sharing all their classes at Berkeley, including this lady. Now, this lady teaches biology. She's the most famous biology teacher that Berkeley ever had. And she retired from Berkeley. And so in retiring from Berkeley, they brought her back to do videos explaining biology. Hundreds of thousands of people watch each one of these. She taught maybe a few thousand people during her entire career. But in a few months' time, she was teaching 10, 20, 100 times as many people. The internet made her celebrity professor. The internet also took Sergey Brin, the founder of Google, right? They bring Sergey Brin into Berkeley. He does a talk. And if you see here, 144,000 people watched his video within a month or two. So people around the world can watch Sergey Brin or can watch Marion Diamond, the biology professor, or listen to people in Stanford, iTunes and Stanford lectures. No. I couldn't get into Stanford. I couldn't get into Berkeley. My test scores, I couldn't get into the littlest school around. But today I can learn from Stanford and Berkeley. The world's become open for learning is basically the premise of the book. Now, there's nobody grading that, but that's coming. I'm going to talk more about that. Okay, oops, there it is. Let's try that again. There we go. My friend Lucifer Chu. Self-named Lucifer, beacon of light. He didn't really know what it meant. He's a white angel, not a dark angel. He's from Taiwan. Okay? So Lucifer is in Taiwan. He translates Lord of the Rings to Chinese, makes $1 million by age 26. What do you do when you have $1 million at age 26, right? You get an idea. You hear about MIT putting their courses on the internet, and your brilliant idea is to translate all these courses to traditional and simplified Chinese, free to the world. He used half of his money. One person can change the world. And the first time I gave this talk, I called it, oops, I didn't mean to share that. Lucifer came on stage. He flew in from Taiwan to Vancouver. We gave the talk together. Actually, he's a fascinating individual. He's now translating The Hobbit. And by the way, Lord of the Rings translation never got to mainland China. It's now going to mainland. He's going to be a multi-millionaire at some point. Unfortunately, ladies, he just got married. So, you know. But this is Lucifer. He dresses as Gandalf oftentimes, or he's always in black. He's a gamer, you know. And he has the OOPS network, the open source, open courseware prototype system with the world's largest translation group in the world. Now, my team has looked at the apprenticeship process within the OOPS network. We looked at the community of practice. We looked at the kind of apprenticeship. We looked at the scaffolding and all this stuff. We studied the social aspects, the community of practice there. Now, at other universities, they've put up their courses. They put up a syllabus, a schedule, lecture materials, readings, announcements at Tufts University or at Johns Hopkins University or Notre Dame. Seven universities in Japan. Universities in Seoul, I think Seoul National. But the second university in after MIT. And by the way, when MIT made the announcement to put their courses on the internet for free, I wrote a note to their president to offer my services, and he never wrote back. That was in 2001. I wanted to get that job to run that. Now they've got all 1,900 courses up on the internet. After MIT, the second university in was, what do you think? Harvard's a good guess. No. What do you think? It was at Stanford. Who said that? It's a really good guess. No. What do you think? Back row people. Come on. Someone's got a guess in the back row. Go ahead. What do you think?
Not Wisconsin-Madison.
Not Wisconsin-Madison. Actually, that's where I went to school. They're pretty far behind, actually. The second university then was the National University of Vietnam. They had Fulbright scholars there in economics, and they didn't want to lose their knowledge, so they put that up on the internet. So a lot of different players. And India's got some folks doing things. I mean, it's all going around the world, this notion of open courseware, right? When you got all this open courseware, you need to have a portal to kind of make sense of it all. And there are two portals. One I'm going to point out is called the OER Commons, or Open Education Resource Commons. So if you need a course in nutrition, you need a course in digital photography, you need a course in, you know, money and banking, accounting, my old field, you can go to OER Commons and look them up and find them. Another website is called the NROC, or National Repository of Online Courses. Those two websites are brother-sister. I think the same organization kind of creates these. Yeah, this has some K-12 as well as college. This one, just the OER, just has college ones, the OER Commons. Anyhow, these are portals of stuff. When you have all this free stuff on the web, you might have new ventures taking place. Well, my friend here, Shai Reshef, he was the chairman of Cramster. And Shai sold Cramster. I don't know how much money he sold it for, but he took $1 million out of that money, and he's creating the University of the People. He's creating a free university where if you live, there's a small cost to enter, like $20, $30, $40, depending upon if you're in a developing country or a developed country, and your tests cost money to have assessed. Everything else is free. He had two courses in the fall last year, first courses in computer science and in writing. He had 180 students the first semester, with 800 instructors, 5 instructors for every student. It's a new model, and it was free education. He wants to be accredited. He's in Pasadena, California now. He's an Israeli entrepreneur. He's now in Pasadena. He may move somewhere else. This woman here created Peer-to-Peer University, P2PU, which is a way to help people find their way on the internet. It's mentoring, counseling, and tutoring services online. They create classes. You sign up to take the class. There's no accreditation behind the class. There's no credit, but there's no cost either. So it's basically getting tutored online. Opener number 5 gets us into portals of stuff. Here in Australia and Oceania, there are 96 journals that are open access. In Africa, there are over 400. Asia, over 600. Europe, almost 1,000. And well over 1,000 in both North and South America. Open access journals means your articles are available for free. I have a course on the Web 2.0, 32 pages long. Everything's free. They're all open access articles, right? Times are changing when students don't have to buy a book as a result of all this. But it's not just about text online. And by the way, this open access repository or format comes from Stanford as well. There's a professor there by the name of John Walensky that's pushed ahead on this area of open access journals. In video side of things, this is where things are really exploding today. And Elliot Mazey, a corporate trainer in the U.S., says this is a disruptive technology, that we've got video blogs, webinars, webcasts, keynotes. This is being taped as a podcast, not as video. So we have the chance to learn from so many venues today. And in yesterday's talk, my keynote was filmed. My talk at Moodle on Monday, my morning keynote was filmed. People can watch them later. You know, you can assign them to your class, all free. But there are so many video tools today on the web or portals. I've created an index of all 40 that I could find. You got the BBC, you got CNN and MSNBC, of course, Google Video, but you might not know about Fora TV. Fascinating website with famous book authors on it and famous people in the technology field like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs or Steve Wozniak, who created Apple Computer. Vin Cerf, who predicts the interplanetary internet, being interviewed at Fora TV. It's a great little website up on the web. Current TV, Al Gore's network, the woman caught behind the lines in North Korea. Remember the two reporters? That was Current TV, right? But Al Gore is getting divorced, as you might, from Tipper, so that's going to be called the Tipper TV now. She's going to get this, I think. I don't know. In the divorce proceedings. I don't know. But we got MIT World, YouTube EDU. You might not know that, you know, people might, YouTube, no good. How about YouTube EDU? More than 250 universities have their web stream, their contents in YouTube EDU. K-12 has TeacherTube. Link TV has National Geographic Specials. Explore, with people exploring around the world. Big Think, people like Deepak Chopra talking about religion. We got Sir Richard Branson talking about the airline industry and, you know, famous folks around the world with short 2-minute, 3-minute deep thoughts about the world and where it's going. Howcast and Wonder How Too. If you want to know how to run a marathon or cook a meatloaf or, you know, fix your plumbing at home, they have it. Clip Chef also. You want to cook Korean beef? Clip Chef will tell you how to do that. TV Lesson. Experts teaching about digital photography or archery or something like that. Book TV, interviews of authors in Book TV. The Research Channel, self-explanatory what that is. iVideo Song has free music lessons as well as paid ones. You can hear in America we had someone called Hall & Oates, famous in the 80s, 70s and 80s. They're up there in iVideo Song teaching you how to play guitar and stuff like that. So you got Link TV, National Geographic Specials, and my friend John Bauermaster, who did the Ocean's 8 series from a sea kayak. He went around the oceans of the world. He went to Antarctica by sea kayak and all this stuff. All this was done and now is available on the web for free. It's fascinating what's available and possible through Link TV. And they have what's called Television Without Borders, Global Link for World Educators, or the GLOW Network. They actually have curriculum for teachers to use the video content. They have Latin Pulse, Global Pulse, to hear what's going on in Latin America. You want to hear what's going on in the Middle East, they have a Middle East channel, all in Link TV. As I mentioned, Fora TV. Famous people like Michelle Ray, who transformed the Washington, D.C. schools. She's being interviewed. The famous multiple intelligence expert, Howard Gardner, comes in and asks her questions during that. Fascinating stuff. Vin Cerf from Sun Microsystems. Fascinating stuff. I mentioned TV Lesson, but I didn't mention Academic Earth. Now, Academic Earth is indexing all the free videos of the universities, like the best of Yale and Harvard and MIT and Oxford and so forth. All linked at Academic Earth. Pretty cool stuff, right? Now, a couple of years ago, this fisherman in Antarctica caught the world's largest squid, the world's largest mollusk ever found. and he put it on ice. He was looking for the Antarctic toothfish, also known as the Chilean sea bass. He caught this colossal squid by mistake. He put it on ice, and it took scientists in Wellington, New Zealand, 14 months to figure out how to thaw it out. When they thawed it out, they found it had eyeballs the size of soccer balls. These are the lenses of the eyes. It had a translucent body. It had claws that could kill whales. Maybe. It's nothing I want to find under the ocean anytime soon. So they put this up on Discovery News, live, and all sorts of TV stations, right? Free to the world. Kids in schools could find out about the colossal squid the same time that scientists found out about the colossal squid. You see, you don't have to wait for it to get into books for 4 or 5 years or 3 years or whatever. And 2 months later, when this gentleman found a gigantic squid off the coast of Santa Cruz in California, CNN covered this and other places covered this live. Science is going live today for kids in schools to learn about at the same time scientists find out about it. When this gentleman, Jorn, from the University of Oslo, found the missing link, or a missing link, and put the research out, the research went out, on May 20th, 2009, the article came out in the Public Library of Science, which is an open access article. See, genetics people and biology people are upset about the price of journals, so they have a free journals called the Public Library of Science. The same day, Sir David Attenborough explains what this missing link means at the web portal for the book. The book came out the same day the website went live, the same day the research article came live, and they're all open access. And that means that college kids, university kids, can read about this the same day scientists found out about this. This is a whole new ball game when this is happening, right? It's no longer secretive, and we're not going to tell anybody what's going on until we really, you know, so when science goes live, and pictures and videos and so forth, it's a really interesting times we're living in. When brains are being dissected live on the internet, we had a gentleman who had part of his brain removed in the 1950s because he had epileptic seizures, so he was age 10. Well, he died 2 years ago and donated his brain to science, and they sliced, you know, and diced him or whatever on the web. Now, it's not a website I frequent and so forth, but this was live. Charles Darwin's website, the University of Cambridge, put up Charles Darwin last year, free to the world. 200-year anniversary of his birth, 150-year anniversary of Origin of the Species. And you find out what he had for dinner, all the letters to his wife, all of his writings. You find out he had a darn laptop computer, which made him so darn productive. You know. But if he had had a laptop computer when he came into port off the Beagle, he probably would have been killed. I mean, he didn't come out with his research for decades until someone else was going to publish his research, right? But fascinating websites from Cambridge, fascinating websites from Duke. Duke University put Thomas and Jane Carlyle's writings when they were in Scotland and Victorian England. Their letters to Charles Dickens, their letters to Mary Shelley who wrote Frankenstein, their letters to Emerson and Browning and Tennyson, all on the web, all hyperlinked together, just put up last year. So you find out about Victorian England. You can go back even further in time to Samuel Pepys, his diaries from the 1660s in England. Find out about the Great Plague or the Great Fires of England. He had a laptop, as you noticed, too. Now, he was apparently an admiral of the British Navy at one point. His boss reported to the king. He loved his women. He loved his wine. He loved his booze. Very interesting diary. My friend Phil Guilford's making it a blog post one day at a time. So you find out one day at a time, and he's hyperlinked it all to Google Earth, Google Maps, Wikipedia. So you find out more about Samuel Pepys than even Samuel Pepys knew about himself. Okay? He had a diary for 10 years, and then his eyesight started going on him, so he had to stop in 1669. But apparently, you grew up in England, Rick. Have you heard about the Pepys diary? Okay. So one day at a time it's going up. You might want to check. And this guy's a webmaster. So you got a webmaster from Guildford, England, right? And he's become famous for one idea. It's a cool idea. You got now the Royal Society putting up all the work of, you know, Captain Cook, who apparently found a few of the bays around this area, right? And you got Benjamin Franklin and so forth. Actually, the bay off my window from my hotel, I see that he discovered. Isaac Newton and so forth. They decided to put up all their work free to the world. I mean, when you got portals like this popping up, I thought opener number one and opener number five were the least important. Opener number one being ebooks, opener number five being a portal of stuff, become the most important stuff that's happened. When you have all this free stuff, you need ways to index it again. My friend Richard Baranek, who went to Wisconsin the same time I did, we never met. He was a computer science guy, engineering guy. He created something called Connections, misspelled, I guess it's a British spelling, C-O-N-N-E-X-I-O-N-S, free portal of a repository of free books, animations, simulations from kindergarten kids through college and university. There's something called Merlot, M-E-R-L-O-T, not the wine Merlot, but Merlot, the website of sharing. It's a referatory or set of links with 21,000 learning objects, 78,000 members. So we have Merlot and Connections and Jorum out of the UK, J-O-R-U-M, which used to be for British people only, now it's free to the world for everybody, J-O-R-U-M. So this is interesting. Now, Merlot is a peer-reviewed site. It's peer-reviewed, so you can get the contents with feedback on from people. So it's a peer-reviewed website. It's very fascinating kind of a website out there. Okay, the last five openers I'll walk through in the next 5, 6, 7 minutes, and we'll open up for questions. This one here is about learner participation. The YouTube guys letting us put up our YouTube videos, or the Wikipedia people, and so forth. We used to have education like so, right? Now we have education like this, more interactive, more collaborative, more discussion-based, more mobile, and so forth. We have John Dewey to thank, who believed in project-based learning. We have Ivan Illich, who believed in de-schooling society, that we need to get people into the real world, collecting real-world data. He believed in 1969, 1970, that the computer will create connections among people, like social networking. He could get your advisors and mentors online. He was talking about this in his book, De-Schooling Society. Fascinating guy, actually. He believed that in schools, we just teach boring stuff. Seymour Papert about active learning, constructivistic kinds of learning. We got Stephen Hipple from the Ultra Lab in the UK, from Anglia Ruskin University, who created Not School for kids who are bullied in high school or pregnant or whatever. They can go online and learn instead. You got John Seely Brown, who wrote the book, The Social Life of Information. He wrote an article called Minds on Fire a couple of years ago about participatory learning. He's probably one of the big experts in the field of learning through participating, learning through constructing knowledge. And then Aaron Jenkins, who also went to grad school at the same time I did. We never met. He was in the history department. He talks about how to deal with the digital culture. And he actually was in a recent, as you can see, in a recent Star Wars kind of movie or Star Trek movie. They actually did film him up. Okay, we have people like Chad Hurley and Steve Chen from YouTube to thank. We have Kevin Rose, who got us to vote on news and let news percolate up to the top that the people decide is the important news. We have Jimmy Wales. Now, Jimmy Wales dropped out of my university to create Wikipedia. I went and visited his headquarters in the Soma District of San Francisco last year or 2 years ago with my son. He took my picture here. They had 10 employees at Wikipedia. They were hiring 2 people. They were in a hiring spree, you know. But, you know, you got not just Wikipedia, 10 million documents. People said it would not work. But they have Wiktionary, an online dictionary, WikiQuotes, you want quotes from Shakespeare or whatever, WikiSource, original documents of Darwin and, you know, Freud and Anna Freud and so forth, and Jane Austen and Hemingway. If you don't believe in crowdsourced content, if you don't believe in Wikipedia, at least you should take a look at WikiQuote and WikiSource. It's the original stuff from people. The people have contributed it to the site. Wikiversity, maybe eventually an online university. WikiBooks, I'm doing research on WikiBooks and having my kids write books with others from other campuses at the WikiBooks website. So Jimmy dropped out of my university to create Wikipedia. So I tell my students to drop out. Make a name for yourself, right? IBM, 17,000 people at IBM have blogs. 5, 6 years ago, they were concerned about one person having a blog. 53,000 employees on their social networking site. 500,000 participants in their crowdsourcing jams at IBM. So the business world's embracing social networking today. The K-12 world, this woman here came to my talk in Atlanta 2 years ago, and she sat in the front row and said, Kurt, can I Ustream you? I had new shoes on. I had given 4 talks that day in Atlanta, 2 the day before in D.C., and I was dead tired. 3 people came to that talk at the end of the day. It was a best of. No one cared. She comes to the front row and says, can I Ustream you? I said, well, what does it mean? So I put your camera up there, and I put it at my own TV station. So sure, go ahead. You know, there's 1 billion people out there can watch, right? She puts it up there, and she, I'll Twitter post on, you know, blog it. By the way, my name's Cool Cat Teacher. I'm like, oh, no, not Cool Cat Teacher. I heard about her. Now I got to be good, right? So she streams me up. 2 minutes later, I'm getting questions come up through her from my friends around the world. They're watching this. They have heard about this. My friend Bernie Dodge in San Diego, who created the WebQuest, says, send Kurt this question. My student, Jennifer Madrell, says, send Kurt a note. Tell him we're streaming, we're U-streaming the U-stream. We're in New York City with hundreds of people. We're all watching him live at a conference in New York City. So I have three people in Atlanta, hundreds of people in New York City. Now, truly, the world's become open when that kind of stuff happens. My friend Jeff LeBeau, has something called World Bridges, where people around the world form connections. He has a weekly EdTech talk show. He has a teacher talk show. He does streaming video and streaming podcasts on different topics. He was an educational technologist with a master's degree. Didn't know what he wanted to do with his life, so he shaved his head, went to Thailand, shaved his head, and thought about it for a year, and came up with the idea of World Bridges. True story. And now World Bridges has these connections of people, global leaders around the world. And every Sunday night, which would be Monday afternoon your time, they have an EdTech talk show. The Queen has the Royal Channel. You know, the Queen is a great TV channel. She's trying to save the knowledge, you know, on one place, the Royal Channel. Now, when the Queen has... she's uploading and downloading videos. When the Dalai Lama has a podcast, the Dalai Lama has a Twitter post. Barack Obama has a BlackBerry. The world's really changing, right? When my friend Godwin Agudi has no running water, no electricity, no computers, and no computer teachers in Sega, Ghana, and my other friend Yan visits and films them and puts them in current television, she wins awards. She wins awards in current TV, and I write to her. The day I go to Current TV, she's got the award-winning pod. She's a computer scientist by day, filmographer at night, and during her break times. She travels to she's now in Western China filming on the three of her damn displacement stuff going on. She's probably put in jail for some of the stuff she does, actually. She's now my friend. I connected with her one day online. She read my entire World is Open book, gave me feedback on the whole darn thing. When I got to Denver, Colorado, where she lives, she picks me up, takes me all around. It's funny, you just bumble into someone one day. He's my friend. He's writing to me all the time. Godwin's writing to me. I sent him books. He says, you know, I've now got running water. I now got electricity. I now got computers. I now got a computer teacher. Some of it's thanks to Current TV. Because people come and volunteer and come to Sega Ghana to visit him. My student, Kwame, has an outsourcing company in Ghana. I've connected the two of them together to get him even more computers. It might happen. We're not sure if it will happen. Things happen on the internet. They're bizarre. You know, so much is possible today that one person, one thing can change the world. He says it's like ants on a hill. He's going to get one computer at a time. He watches these ants on a hill. It's a fascinating video. My friend Jonathan Ziltrain has a book called The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. And it's a free book from Yale Press, and it's annotated, so you can comment on the book. And he'll comment back to you. He's now at Harvard. His friend Yoki Bankler at Harvard has a book, The Wealth of Networks, not The Wealth of Nations. It's a wiki. You can change it up if you want. You can translate it and do all sorts of things. Open participatory books. Not just a static book, but a participatory book. You can comment on these books. My friend Trip Adler just turned 25 last week. He's still single and he'll be a billionaire soon. You walk into his office like I did in Chinatown, San Francisco, and you can, ladies, get a date with this guy. He created iPaper, interactive paper, where if you go to the internet, you can download Plato's Republic or something else in 1 second, 2 seconds. Interactive paper. And you can comment on it, form social networks on it. He created something called Scribd, or Scribbled, or Scribe with a D. It's YouTube for text. Genealogical records, music scores, poetry, love letters you never sent to somebody. My qualifying exams... 3 people had read in 20 years. I put it on Scribd. Within a day, 100 people read it, commented on it, discussed it. If you ever wrote a book you never published, put it in Scribd. You want to join a group on public health, nursing, nutrition, photography, Scribd will have a group on it. It's a fascinating website. Number 7 gets us into collaboration. Collaborate or die, as the sign says here. You know, we've got kids in schools today corresponding with others around the world. Cool Cat Teachers students in Georgia correspond with this group of students in Bangladesh, analyzing books together in the Flat Classrooms projects. In Indiana, we have something called the International Studies in Indiana Schools, where kids talk to others in India and in the Middle East and other parts of the world. Some of it is free, right, with webcams. I have I was asked to talk to Manchester students, University of Manchester students, and 5 minutes later I'm up online in the UK. I was asked to talk to South China Normal students from my home office. Boom, we're there. I had John Traxler from the University of Wolverhampton talk to my class this past spring. Boom, he's in talking about mobile learning. He's one of the famous people in mobile. Stephen Downs from Canada, one of the most famous bloggers in the education space. Boom, he's there. I had IntelliGirl from Second Life, and I didn't want her to be felt left out, so I put my little pink head on, as you can see. She has this flaming red hair, and she has a book called Second Life for Dummies. She has 3 8-year-olds. She married a guy who had an 8-year-old, and they now have 4 8-year-olds at home. So she says, plug my book. I need to sell a lot of books for 4 8-year-olds at home. So she comes in. She lives 2 miles from my house. We still got her in by webcam, whereas John's in the UK. He's in Canada. You know, we have other folks from Singapore. We didn't get the Dalai Lama. There's the Dalai Lama doing a stream. This is a little project we did in Korea. We had 21 cameras or 30 cameras simultaneously for our meeting. Fascinating synchronous stuff today. But it's not just about synchronous in online, but synchronous, it's not just about collaboration online. Collaboration in face-to-face settings has become important. Universities are rethinking their classroom spaces today for active learning classrooms. Soon we'll have holographic images coming in. In fact, that already exists in Canada. They have teleported instructors to northern parts of Toronto or northern parts of Ontario. They take an instructor in Toronto, go to First Nation people in Sioux Lookout. They come in teleported, and these are First Nation people who don't have paved roads, might not have running water, but they have teleported instructors, you know. Cisco and Hewlett-Packard have telepresence, where you have wraparound meetings. You have the video coming in and audio, so it looks like you're in the same room with other people at the same time. I was interviewed by folks in San Jose this spring about my book. I came in here, they were here, it looked like we're in the same room together. Telepresence has become popular. It costs about $60,000 to $80,000 for one of these units. It's not cheap, but people are moving to it. Alternative reality learning, like Will Wright from The Sims and Spore and other games online. We have Second Life. We have law being taught at Harvard in Second Life with a father-daughter team. He has face-to-face office hours. She has online ones. We have teacher training in Georgia in Second Life. Medical training in Texas. We have IntelliGirl teaching English in Second Life, and hot tub chats with guest authors in Second Life at Pepperdine University. All sorts of things in Second Life. Number 9 gets us into mobile learning. 60,000 people an hour are getting mobile access. That's the size of the city I live in. 60,000 people an hour. 15 million people a month in India are getting mobile access. 40,000 people a week in Rwanda. You know, more than half of the world has a mobile phone today. So when people talk about where are we going, it's the mobile devices and soon bendable text. Sony and Samsung are trying to create bendable screens, right? So mobile's where it's at. Pocket school. In the pocket school project, your teacher is in your pocket. This little $20, $30, $40, $50 MP3 kind of player. Does literacy training for kids in Honduras and Mexico and now Rwanda and India and inner city United States. The teacher's in your pocket. So that for migrant worker, their kids in Latin America might not have a teacher or a school. So this comes, and then they have a bicycle for $30 that can recharge it. So your whole school can be $80 or something like that, in effect, with this kind of device. So my friend Paul Kim at Stanford does what's called the Pocket School Project, the mobile learning. He uses alien pedagogy. He drops these things down. He says, aliens have dropped these off, puts them all down. I'll let you take a look at that. It does Spanish training, English training, all that kind of stuff. He drops these down. He says, okay, aliens have given me these devices. I don't know what to do with them. You guys figure it out. And then the kids figure out what to do, and then they share with him. He calls it alien pedagogy. Paul tells me that by December there'll be a tablet computer that costs less than $100. We know where there's the One Laptop Per Child project, which costs well more than $100. Gaming. My son used to play Halo. It's a bang-em-up, shoot-em-up game. I said, what are you doing now, Alex? He said, we're playing Farmville. Farmville's a little game where you grow plants and crops and you share and you help others out. So we've gone from a bang-em-up, shoot-em-up kind of society, I think, to 90 million people doing Farmville. Farmville? Are you doing Farmville? I've heard of Farmville. very popular. You're doing Farmville? You're doing Farmville? A couple of you over here? Yeah. Times have changed. Got a couple minutes left. This gentleman here from Stanford has a mobile phone that's become a flute. He plays his iPhone as a flute for $1.99. I was in Austin, Texas a couple months ago. Someone downloaded this flute over dinner. We started playing his flute during dinner. Maybe tonight Rick and I will download. If you got an iPhone, we can download this and play your flute. But you got Twitter Peak to update on Twitter. You got Wiki Reader to get update on wikis. You got the LiveScribe Pen to record lectures like this one. This gentleman here stalks me at conferences. He records all my talks with his pen. And you click on his notes and you can hear the audio that goes with it. It has a camera and it has a microphone.